And welcome back. Most of us have heard the phrase, first in shoes, first in booze, and last in the American League. Last in the American League refers to the largely unsuccessful St. Louis Browns baseball team, but loyal fans loved the Browns and some were heartsick when the team moved to Baltimore to become the Baltimore Orioles. The Browns story is told in a very colorful coffee table book titled St. Louis Browns, The Story of a Beloved Team. Joining me in studio is Ed Wheatley. He co-authored the book with Bill Borst and Bill Rogers, all members of the St. Louis Browns Historical Society. It's so nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Congratulations on the book. It really is very, very nicely done.
We had a great publisher in Reedy Press, a local St. Louis company, and they were just tremendous to work through. We've had cooperation with the Cardinals, and actually we've had cooperation from the whole community, not just in St. Louis, the baseball community around the country, people wanting to tell the story because there really hasn't been a book like this. And people really have forgotten the Browns, and there's a lot of reasons for that.
Why are you guys hanging on to it, you and your co-authors and the society that you've created?
Well, I think it's important. I mean, the Browns played here for 52 years. I mean, how can you forget that? And as we have book events, I mean, the crowds that have come out are outstanding. And at times it's like the Antique Roadshow. They're bringing things. You know, one lady, here is my ticket from the World Series in 1944, or here's my pass. Some guy said, I've been carrying my Brownies Brigade card, which got him into games after school, because most games were at 2 o'clock, for 70-some-odd years in his wallet, and he couldn't wait to show it. I mean, there is this untapped love and memory. Well, first of all, it's baseball, and St. Louis and baseball. But this team, how many times? This was my father's team. This was my grandfather's team. And they want to know about that. But it's really like, you know, you go to Los Angeles. They remember the Brooklyn Dodgers, and they, you know, keep that legacy of Jackie Robinson and sure. Roy Campanella, Don Newcomb alive. You know, Oakland, they remember all the World Series champions of Connie Mack in Philadelphia. And the Atlanta Braves, they, you know, Hank Aaron hit a lot of home runs in Milwaukee, and Warren Spahn won a lot of games in Milwaukee and Boston. But Baltimore doesn't do anything with the Browns. They basically said the Browns ended and were buried in 1953 after the season, before they moved to Baltimore in 54. So it's really, we're the ones keeping this alive, and there's just this feeling, and we have found it. Not only is these other, there is no Dodgers fan club anymore in Brooklyn. The Philadelphia Athletics fan club has died. We have over 500 members across the country in the Browns fan club, and just last month we had over 250 at our annual luncheon.
But, you know, I understand everything you're saying, but what mystifies me is this great loyalty to a team that has one of the worst records over that 50-plus year period than any team in baseball.
Well, that's true. I mean, I won't deny. I mean, they lost 1,000 more games than they won. They were in totality losers, but the thing that was really interesting as you start outlining this and, you know, you look for stories or you look for pictures and what's the story, is the unique nature and the stories that come. I mean, some of the stuff you couldn't even dream and come up with. They're so fascinating. And the other thing is there were times the Browns were very good. There were some really great players on the Browns.
I was surprised, and going through the book, at some of the stats that a couple of these players put up.
Oh, correct. I mean, you know, in the early years, the Browns came to St. Louis in 1902. The Cardinals had joined the National League, which was formed in 1876. The Cardinals joined the National League in 1892. But for the first two decades when the Browns and Cardinals coexisted, the Browns were the better team. I mean, the St. Louis was a Browns town those first two decades. And then there's a series of events that really kind of in the theme of the book, you know, these what-ifs or these series of maybe three big events happened that could have changed the whole tome of the of history.
Let's have a couple of those.
Okay. First of all, you know, I would really kind of would start with Branch Rickey. You know, Branch Rickey actually started as a Browns player. He was a catcher. Uh-huh. Not a very good one. He holds the record for most steals against a catcher. And as the Washington Post said one day after a game in which 12 players stole on him, all you have to do is start running to steal against Branch Rickey. He then became manager, and he was a general manager and executive with the Browns. And, you know, he was a very forward-thinking individual, and he had these ideas of a farm system. Well, he and the owner of the Browns clashed egos, if you will. That was Philip DeCatsby Ball was the owner. So Branch Rickey leaves the Browns and goes to the Cardinals. The other thing in this story is the Browns played in Sportsman's Park. I mean, this is one of these things people always think, well, the Sportsman's Park was the Cardinals. No. The Browns owned Sportsman's Park from 1902 until it was bought in 1953. The Cardinals played over on a field by Fairgrounds Park on Natural Bridge and Grand Avenue right off there. And it was called Robeson Field. Well, as Rickey got to the Cardinals, that field was condemned because a lot of those days fields were made out of wood. Sportsman's Park was steel and concrete. He comes and he makes a deal to the Browns because there's the one thing the Browns always needed, and that was money. They were always looking for more money. So he signs a long—
That's because nobody went to the games.
Well, to the extent of that. But there were times they had, you know, it wasn't inconsistent in those periods. And again, you got to remember, they at that time were the fair-haired child of St. Louis. And he signs a long-term deal to play in Sportsman's Park. And that's why Sportsman's Park had more major league games than any other stadium, because they played every day, either the Cardinals or the Browns. And he then sells the property where Robeson Field was to the City of St. Louis school system, and it becomes Beaumont High School. So all of a sudden, the Cardinals, they don't have to maintain a stadium and pay all the sundry costs. Branch Rickey's desire is invented. He creates the farm system. He puts the money there, which then leads to the great Cardinal teams, World Series teams of, you know, 26, 28, 30, 31, 34, 42, 43, 44, 46. So the tide then turns.
Weren't the Browns, the management of the Browns, ownership of the Browns, trying almost from day one to just force the Cardinals right out of town?
Well, that was the goal. That's when they were originally the St. Louis Browns, when the American League was formed in 1901. They weren't the original inaugural team. There was a team in Milwaukee called the Milwaukee Brewers. And Ben Johnson, when he created the American League, felt St. Louis's team was soft in attendance and operations, and he moved the Browns from Milwaukee to St. Louis to compete. And through the whole story of the Browns, it's always this challenge between the Cardinals and the Browns, you know, who was going to survive, just as it was happening in Philadelphia and Boston, in those cities, that one team would prevail.
Why weren't they very good?
Well, I think a lot of it was, you know, first of all, there were periods they were really good. The 20s, we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
But it was really money, and it was, you know, kind of almost somewhat of a death spiral. As soon as you get a really good player, you trade him for money. Mm-hmm. You know, then it was also a situation, you know, there was the Depression in the war years, where it taxed the operations, you know, attendance. You know, there was a whole season in which they drew 80,000. I mean, we're talking most teams were drawing 200, 300, 400,000. It's not 3 million like we see here today in St. Louis. And as you had less income, you know, how you paid and how you played. So they were always, you know, you get a guy, he wins the Vern Stevens, he wins the home run title. You trade him to Boston. I mean, that became their situation.
They had a couple of players, and yet I've forgotten their names. I mean, they're not memorable, but they should be. 400 hitters.
Oh, yeah.
And home runs, stolen bases. I mean, records that were just astonishing for the day. And some, I guess, still exist.
Oh, many of them still exist in several formats. As you said, you know, 200 hit seasons are very rare.
Sure.
If you look at, like, the end of the 2017 baseball season, how many had teams had 200 hits by a player? Very few of them. You know, and they also play 162 games versus 154 then. There was a period where the Browns had three players get 200 hits, and they did it consecutive years. They also had, you know, George Sisler hit over 400 multiple times. They also had the only outfield in major league history. This is a good trivia question. What's the best hitting outfield of all time? It's the St. Louis Browns. They had three outfielders, five straight years, hit over 300, the same three players. And, you know, these are the things of those time and those periods that really were a great team. But as they said, the tide kind of turned. You know, if they would have won the 1922 pennant, gotten to the World Series, maybe that would have made them the high hopes, you know.
More what ifs.
It's a full story of what ifs and comedies.
You mentioned players that left. I didn't realize that Don Larson, who pitched the perfect game for the Yankees in the World Series back in the 50s, that he was a Brown, And that Bob Turley, who also was successful with the
Cy Young,
exactly. These guys just hung around for a cup of coffee, right?
Yeah, they both of them came up. Don Larson was just in town with us at our annual luncheon last month, and he's been here the last 2 years. He loved his time in St. Louis. You know, I say we call him up, Don, you want to come to our one of our events? I'll be there. He loved St. Louis. He was a rookie in 1953. He and Turley went to Baltimore as part of the move of the team. And from there, there was a trade that sent him from Baltimore to the Yankees.
What is some of the wacky stuff that comes to mind, the characters?
Well, you know, the first thing that everybody thinks about with the Browns, and I think this is one of the things that has tainted the Browns' legacy.
I know what you're going to say.
Is Bill Veeck and those latter years. Eddie Goodell's incident.
The midget.
Well, the little guy, 3'7", pinch hitter. And, you know, that was an event that took place in 1951, trying to get publicity because Veeck felt he didn't have the players. So he was going to get people in the stands through his circus events because there were times he would have circus performers along the field before the games and after the games. But he had a pinch hitter, a 3'7", little guy named Eddie Goodell came up. Walked on four pitches. You know, it's a long, hard story how, you know, you better not swing, you know, because Veeck, as story goes, and Bob Bragg, the great St. Louis Post writer, was there, and he said, I heard him. I'm going to shoot you if you swing. You better not. So with his knee shaking, he took four pitches, goes to first base, then walks to the dugout into infamy. Yeah. They had grandstand manager night. It's where – they put Zach Taylor, the Browns manager, on a rocking chair on the top of the dugout and said, "You stay out of it." And there was a section of the grandstands where the people all had placards with yes or no, and they would ask them questions. And probably the biggest example was Hank Arf, big first slugging first baseman, you know, that era of the 40s, 50s, the big home run hitting guys. And Hank Arf is from the Schrader funeral home family. He ran it after he left baseball. But he walked. And all the Philadelphia Athletics had to do was just watch that grandstand. Should he steal? He's one of the slowest guys in all baseball. Fans say, yeah. He's thrown out by 25 feet. And that, where incident after incident like that, were things that Major League Baseball finally got fed up with. I mean, you know, and they forced Veeck to sell. But they had situations, I mean, you know, just those were the Veeck things. And he was just trying to be a showman.
He was P.T. Barnum.
He was the P.T. Barnum. That's what I call him in there. He's the P.T. Barnum of baseball. And he worked very hard. You know, he did things. Last night we did a presentation on the book at Kirkwood Library. And a lady said, my sister, when she was born, she got a letter from Bill Veeck. And in the book you'll see the actual letters where he sent a letter inviting every child who was born with tickets to bring their parents to a Browns game. And he also, if you were a boy, you also got a contract to appear in spring training in 18 years. So, I mean, he was doing all kinds of things. But, I mean, the fascinating thing is you asked the question about the Browns. I mean, there were the little incidents and stories. Dizzy Dean, you know, nobody really remembers Dizzy Dean was a Brown for one day, one game. You know, he was an announcer. He had been out of baseball 6 years, really not a good pitcher for about 10, because, you know, after he left the Cardinals, he bounced around with the Cubs a little. And he was an announcer, and, you know, everybody's heard the story about his language and the school teachers rising up against him. But the players also kind of rose up against him, too, because he wasn't a homer. He told it like it was. You know, this pitcher can't hit the side of the bar, and I could do it. So on the last game of the season in 1947, they said, Dizzy, put your mouth and your arm where your mouth is, and let's see what you do. Well, Dizzy comes out, throws shutout ball for four innings, doubles actually, stretches a single into double, slid in funny into second base, and his back stiffened up. Harry said he would have gone the whole game.
If Dizzy were calling that play, he would have said he slid into second base, right?
Yes, he would. That was the word. The teachers didn't like him using words like slud and all that.
Let me go back to Eddie Goodell for just a moment. I'm not sure of the answer to this question. Did his walking have any impact on the outcome of that game?
No, it really didn't have much of an impact. It was really a publicity stunt. I mean, the whole day was staged there. 1951 was the 50th anniversary of the forming of the American League. It was also the 50th anniversary of Grease-A-Dick Beer, and it was a doubleheader. And it had been billed we were going to have this big celebration, and this cake was rolled out in between games of the doubleheader, and all the fans had been told on the radio, you're going to have cake and ice cream. And this big cake comes out, and, you know, some people thought some showgirl was going to pop out of the cake, and it was instead this little guy comes out. And it was just another little stunt in Bill Veeck's trick of trying to promote people to come to the ballpark.
There's another story that I've heard, and I think it's probably true, concerning the uniform that Eddie Goodell wore that mm-hmm. day. You tell the story.
Okay, that a lot of people, just to go back and make sure everybody's aligned, Bill DeWitt Senior was a longtime general manager and executive of the Browns, and at one point even owned the Browns. And then when Bill Veeck bought them, he stayed as an executive. His son, Bill DeWitt Jr., who is the chairman of the Cardinals, was a bat boy. And you've seen many photos of – there's a particularly famous photo of Babe Ruth in one of his last trips to St. Louis in 1948, shortly before he died, with – Bill DeWitt Jr. showing him how to hold a bat. Mm. But it was Bill DeWitt Jr. as this bat boy. It was his uniform that they put on Eddie Goodell so it would fit, and they put on the back the number 1/8. And the uniform is down in the St. Louis Cardinal Hall of Fame downtown in Ballpark Village, and Mr. DeWitt and the Cardinals were very helpful, and they took the uniform out, and you know we've got a lot of photographs of it in the book, along with Bob Sugarcane, who was the pitcher for the Tigers. He took a ball and he sat there and he wrote down all the events that took place during that at bat. And you know, we've got all the panels of the ball in the book.
Tell you, it's just chock full of photographs and photographs of memorabilia and stuff that you've collected. Mm-hmm. How did you come upon all of this?
Well, you know, I've got a lot of baseball books, and you know, I love baseball. Grew up in you know, want to be a purist. And this is how I always felt, you know, you should approach a book. You know, today it's hard for people to read 2-inch books of just all words. It should be created. The book is about 300-plus vignettes, little stories. And then these are the stories, so let's find the pictures. Because I wanted people to go back in time. This book is all about going back in time. And like I said, I'm going to say this as kind of a caveat. We're giving all the money to this book to charity, so as I push it, I'm not pushing it for my own well-being. Mm-hmm. But people are coming, I got to buy this for my parents. But it was the advertising, the pictures. It was to find the right thing as people go back in time to see Hyde Park beer, Grisadick beer, you know, St. Louis Ice House, Jim Blades. You know, people are going, what's Jim Blades? You know, they don't remember how to shave. Sure. But it was to fill this these vignettes with about 600 to 700 pictures of memorabilia. Like I said, the Dizzy Dean game, we've got the scorecard, we got the ticket stubs, and the pieces from the Eddie Goodell game, we've got all those. And, you know, just all the little pieces of Brown's history and all these great stories.
What did you turn people upside down and shake them to get this out of their pockets?
Well, you know, like I said, the Cardinals helped. You know, with the Browns Historical Society, we've got a collection of the ownership, the former owners of the Browns, their papers, and some memorabilia from the players. But it got to be, once the word was out that we were putting this together, I would get phone calls and people would bring things by and say, does this help you? Would you like to use this? I worked at the Hall of Fame up in Cooperstown. And it was just, but it was amazing how many people, once they heard we were working on a book, started calling us, I've got this, can you use it? And you know, went from there.
Time is running out, but I can't escape the observation that how loyal fans are to teams that don't win. I think of the Cubs and the St. Louis Browns and the old Brooklyn Dodgers, because they didn't win any World Series for years. But people love them.
Well, I think, you know, the biggest honor was in the 44 World Series when Musial, he said, I can't believe it. We've won 2 World Series championships, and everybody's rooting for the Browns. So
it goes. Ed Wheatley, thank you so much for being with us. The book is The St. Louis Browns, The Story of a Beloved Team. It's worth taking a look at, folks, and because the money's going to charity, it's worth even better if you buy it.
Great.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Good luck with the book.
All right.
Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. The program is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.